I am.
Right. The 11th meeting of our Education Reform Committee will come to order, please. Representative Crawford has looked over the minutes, I presume?
Yep.
And moves the minutes of February 8th. Are there any questions, corrections, additions? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of February 8th, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Members, today we have three bills before us, and we're going to hear bills today that focus on parental choice. Representative Fritz will present something to us that allows for parental choice. And then when you get to my bill later on the agenda, that's also an opportunity for parents to weigh in. So welcome to our committee, Representative Patty Fritz. If you would just take a seat at the table. And she has with her, of course, very important leaders in our academies, our state academies. And as they are needed, we'll call on them. So
thank
please
you.
Say your name for the record, Representative Fritz, and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm Representative Patty Fritz, and I represent the Minnesota Faribault State Academies in Faribault, Minnesota, my hometown, and today I have with me the superintendent of the Minnesota State Academies, and Billy Ward, Special Education Director as well.
And so, Representative Fritz, I'm going to move House File 133, recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. And I believe you have an amendment, do you, that you would like?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. I have the A1 amendment.
So, members, I will move H0133A1. So that Representative Fritz has her bill in order. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Your bill is now in the order that you want it to be. Representative Fritz, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that some of you have voted for last year, and thank you. And we're back again. This is, as I said, in Faribault, Minnesota, the Minnesota State Academies for the deaf and hard of hearing and blind and visually impaired. Both of those schools are there on the campus. And you're all invited to come and tour this wonderful, marvelous facility anytime. I'd be happy to bring you, and I'm sure that the folks with me today would like to have you do that as well. But this is a school that has done outstanding service to our deaf and blind communities. And I was at I'm invited every year to come to, and I go to the graduations, and a young mother came to me and said to me that she knew nothing about these schools, and she had a blind daughter that could, and also multiple handicapped as well, that finally they moved to Faribault, and oftentimes that's what people do. And so there it was no option really for people to come, and I don't think they know much about our school. So this gives parents and students an option to come for placement for 60 to 90 days. And I'm going to turn it over to Superintendent Linda Mitchell to explain a little further.
Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Mitchell. It's great
Thank
to see you.
You. Thank
and
you.
Please say your name for the record.
Good morning.
And begin.
I am Linda Mitchell. I have been an employee at the academies for over 30 years. The superintendent for the last 12. We started working on some language that would address a parent option a couple of years ago, and we're surprised to know that most folks didn't realize that we didn't already have that. Our students who come to us, and we serve children from birth to 21 years of age, our students come to us through the local school districts in the state. We are a resource to all of the school districts, and they come through us through the IEP process. So everybody that comes to the academies is on an IEP. Now, having said that, I want to give you just a brief little bit about federal special education philosophy and talk about, and I'll be brief, but unfortunately, at least for us, I think philosophically, as we work with children who are blind and children who are deaf, the special ed philosophy of IDEA is built on what I would call a system of failure. And we have a continuum that goes from top to bottom, from You can be a student in a regular ed class, and you are there with your non-handicapped peers and get some services. You can be a student who is pulled out of the regular class. You can be a student who is in a self-contained different class. You can be a student who goes to a different facility. So these levels of placement are levels of placement that really look at, can you succeed in the regular classroom? No, you can't. Well, if you can't succeed there, then you move to this. We would prefer now, and I should say that because of the location of services for students, unless they live in Faribault or close to Faribault, they live in our dorms. So the placement of services then looks to be what is called the most restrictive environment. What we would prefer to see philosophically is that there is a continuum of services that would go from left to right, and that there would be times potentially when you might need a service over here or a service over here, but this is a fluid kind of continuum. You don't have to stay. In fact, you don't have to stay at the academies for 12 years. We have, and I'm sorry he's not here, but we have an example of a young man who came to us a couple of years ago whose mother did have to argue to get him to have access to the academies, who was then able to return to his public school and is very successful there now. So there may be a time they need to come and learn Braille. There may be a time they need to come and have orientation and mobility services. Once they have those skills, they can go back and be successful in their home district. Having said that, right now, if the IEP team does not agree with placement at the academies, for short-term placement, social, emotional placement, or because they're profoundly deaf or blind, parents don't have an option to be able to send their child there. We work closely with the school district, so we were looking for a solution that worked for them and worked for us. We don't want to be in the position to say, no, you can't, yes, you can, and we also recognize that the school districts are the ones who, and they provide basic aid revenue. That's what the cost is. We try to be as cost neutral as possible. So when a student comes from a school district, the basic aid revenue comes with the child. Now that goes back to the state treasury because we are a line item in the governor's budget, which is separate. Having said that, we try to be as cost neutral as possible. The two things that a district may have to pay for if there is a need for an aid with a child, mm-hmm. or the transportation piece, which is special ed transportation, and then part of that, of course, is reimbursable. Those are the two costs to the districts. So we're working with districts all the time, and we wanted something that would work for them and work for us. So this trial placement would give 60 to 90 days for a student to come to the academies. If it was an appropriate placement that we felt would work, then the parent would have the option to let the child attend.
Very good. Thank you, Superintendent Mitchell. Representative Fritz, would you like your other testifier to speak as well?
I would, if she could. This is
yes, please introduce yourself for the record and tell us your take on this. Okay. Thank
you. My name is Billy Ward, and I'm the Special Education Director at the Academies. I thank you for having us here today. Again, what Linda had said, we have worked very closely with the school districts. We see ourselves as partners with the school districts. We've also worked with MACE, our Minnesota Association of Special Education Directors, Darren Kermis, Michelle Orcott, and then Brad Lundell have assisted us with the language and making sure that we are all on the same page as we look at how we can best serve our students.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Representative Fritz or her testifiers? Is there anyone in the audience? Oh, excuse me, Representative Debke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one question to one of the testifiers regarding the current process. What What would be a disagreement between the IEP team and the parent? Could you give us an example of why the IEP team would say, no, you can't go, and the parent said, yes, we really feel they need this? And I wanted to understand how much the financial exchange comes into that placement as well.
Superintendent Mitchell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are a couple of things that... one of them may be because if this is a large district or a district who has an intermediate program that they work with, they already have a program. So in essence, if they have a teacher of the blind, visually impaired on staff, mm-hmm. or they have access to that, they would say, we already have a program that should be sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do need to explain that right now, when somebody comes to the academies, we are not the beginning part of that process. The school district has to come to us, or the family comes to us, and we have to direct them back to the school district. Right now, when a school district says no, the parents only, what do I say?
Recourse.
Options, recourse, thank you, is to take that through the due process part of special education, which can be mediation, conciliation, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We really can't do much about that. They can ask us to come. We can testify. We can tell them what we provide. But we're really not a part of that. So it still may happen that, and in rural areas and changeover with staff, there may be folks that don't even know we exist. So if the parents don't know and the school district doesn't know, it would be like Representative Fritz has said, somebody comes up and said, we didn't even know you were here. And we know that that is an issue. We do our best to get the word out there. But that would be one of the reasons that someone might not. Philosophically, there may be others, and I know... as an example, parents may want their child to learn Braille, and there are folks who don't think that's necessary, and that may be a discussion. But these are not objective things. These can be very subjective, and again, I think we just want parents to have a little bit more say about the programming that's provided for their kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to stay out of the middle of the argument, if you know what I mean.
Representative Depke,
yeah.
Follow-up.
Thank you very much. I did want to ask the author, do you have a fiscal note on this bill?
No, I do not.
Representative Fritz.
Madam Chair, no, I do not.
All
Representative.
Right. Since you're going to education finance, I assume that's why they're sending you there for that.
Representative Thank Depke, you. We believe there's a little cost involved in here, so to be safe, we're referring it to...
Nope.
The Committee on Finance.
Thank you very much.
Oh, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Superintendent. I think it is Superintendent, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I want to make sure. I just want to, and I think it's wise that we vet out the fiscal note, certainly in the next committee. I just wanted to, I don't have a question. We've been wrangling with this issue for quite a while, and I just want to publicly state that the Academy is an incredible asset to the state. It really serves the needs of students that are very vulnerable and can get pretty easily lost in many of our schools. And I know a while back when you first brought this idea forward that we were struggling with, you know, this whole placement issue, and I just want to commend you for working out, I think, a really balanced way that still respects our laws in regards to placements of these students in our special ed processes, but also allows the Academy to be in a position to be able to continue to be a good resource for our state. So anyway, thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Mariani. And, you know, members, this is a way to empower our parents. And when we have this wonderful facility in our state, because not every state has what we have, we want to make sure parents know this and that they have a process. So thank you, Representative Fritz, for working with the key players to make sure, as Representative Mariani said, that we stay within the law, and yet we allow parents this opportunity, and especially these students. They need to have this. Are there any other questions? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Barrett, for recognizing me.
I like signals.
Sorry. Well, first of all, thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing this forward, because I think this makes a lot of sense. I did have a quick question about the capacity at the academies. Are we under capacity? I mean, do we have open seats, or is it an issue where we're going to have to make some additional facility improvements?
Superintendent Mitchell.
Madam Chair, you know, it's interesting. I'm smiling because we do not have too many kids, let's put it that way. We do have the issue, and I'm watching these population shifts. First of all, one of the great things that has happened has been the newborn infant screening, because what we're finding are the babies. And so our early childhood, even though we are a statewide facility, we're serving from birth to 21, and our 0 to 5, 2 years ago when we started, we had 4 kids and 2 babies. And this last fall, we have 22 kids and I don't know how many babies. Mm-hmm. But when that was passed, we were told that every year you were going to see on average 100 babies who would not initially pass. Now, that doesn't mean that 6 months later they aren't fine. We're not saying that there are 100 every year, but there are 100 that are initially identified. Our biggest challenge now is from that 0 to 5 to make sure that, and because our state is very good at recognizing people's privacy, we get them identified, but then they're much harder to track because we can't know their names. We can provide them with the services. So now we're trying to make sure that we are keeping track of them from 0 to 5, because especially for our deaf kids, what we're attempting to show is that if you can get the early language acquisition for them, they can be on grade level like everybody else. What we've seen in the past and historically has been that when you find out a child, and unfortunately this still does happen, it's gotten more complex because of kids with autism, because of other disabilities, but we still find out when a child is 7 that, oh, guess what, they aren't autistic, they can't hear. Unfortunately, those kinds of things still happen. But what we see is those kids who are language delayed are kids who then end up below grade level, and then we're trying to catch them up. So it's really a good thing that right now, as you're asking questions about our capacities, we had to hire another early childhood teacher, and I won't be surprised if next year we have to hire another one. So we're getting them when they're young, but if we're able to keep those kids on grade level and they have the skills, they may also be able to mainstream as they get older. So on the other campus, what we're seeing is growth in the 18 to 21-year-olds. This is the blind kids. And blind kids, I will generalize here and say, do school pretty well if they have the right assistive technology with them. They really do. They can get the math. They can understand. In a classroom, they're okay. What they need practice with, and sometimes we're a little bit too helpful and we help too much and then they don't learn, they need to learn how to navigate the world. They need to learn how to do their laundry, how to cook for themselves, how to do all those things without their eyes. And so we see a lot of kids who may have completed their high school coursework, but they don't have the skills to live independently to go on to school. So from 18 to 21, that's what we're working on. We have hooked up with South Central College so that our kids can take some classes over there, and they're kind of semi-independent, a little more than they were in high school. So hopefully when they're 21 and they leave, they are able to go on and be successful. So we are not at capacity. We can take more kids, but we do have to make adjustments internally.
Okay.
Representative Whitaker.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank both of you for getting up so early and coming up to the cities this morning from Faribault. 8:15 is early for representatives, let alone people who have to travel to testify, so I thank you for your efforts on that this morning. Just a quick question and then a comment. Representative Fritz, how are you coming with a companion on the Senate side?
Representative Fritz.
Yes, I believe we have a Senate author of.
Very good. And then, Madam Chair,
Representative,
the only other comment that I would make is I know of people from my area who do avail themselves of the service that you provide, and the family has been most pleased with the services, and they have a number of children who have varying issues that you've spoke about today. So I would endorse your work from my conversations with them. So thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions, committee members?
Seeing no signals, hearing no requests, Representative Fritz renew her motion, or a motion on her behalf to pass House File 133 as amended and re-refer it to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The bill is passed and sent on to the Committee on Finance. And thank you very much, ladies, for coming. I'm sure a lot of these members don't even realize, because we have so many new members, mm-hmm. Superintendent Mitchell, about the services that you provide for our children mm-hmm. and our parents. And I know you have great teachers. So thank you so much. Thank you, Representative
Madam Chair,
Fritz.
Thank you, members. Thank you. And the invitation is open for any time you want to come and visit. We'd
yes.
love to show
and,
you.
Oh, if we had the money, we'd be there tomorrow.
All right. Thank you.
But, you know, I have traveled the area, and I've not been there lately, but it's a fascinating tour. Superintendent Mitchell.
Madam Chair, if I would... yes, we are there all the time. Please come at any time. We would be happy to show you around. I would say to those of you who are new members, mm-hmm. I would be happy to come and see you here as well. I certainly can take the time to share with you the things that we're doing and would be happy to do that. So we welcome you. Come to Faribault, too. We're not that far away.
No, you're not.
Right down 35.
Very good.
Thank
very
you.
Good.
Yeah.
Members, before we move on, I did receive an email from Scott Olson, who some of you may recall was the Minsky presenter when we had the Getting Prepared report. And members had asked, did the report on remediation reflect students who had come from our public schools to the colleges or universities who were on IEPs? And yes, they would have been included in those who needed remediation. So those percentages included students on IEPs. He has assured me that when they do the next SLED system, they will separate those out so that we know, indeed, what students need remediation that aren't coming to our colleges and universities on IEPs. So I thought you should know that, because we had questions about that. Then also in your folder is a fact sheet about the school trust royalty income. And I think you'll find this interesting reading, you know, certainly right before you go to sleep at night, about our non-ferrous metallic mineral mining abilities in Minnesota. And I think we can be encouraged by this fact sheet. It was so nice of the DNR to send this over to us. And then we also have, I guess, in the folders, the Getting Started, the 10 Fundamentals of Coordinated State Early Care and Education Data Systems. Yes, and this is what Gadara? Yes, Ms. Gadara mentioned when she was here. So we have lots of good reading and resources. And with that, Representative Kiefer. Welcome to the testifying table. This is your initiation, and we're glad to have you. And would you like to move your house file?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Representative Andrea Kiefer from 56B, and I would like to move house file number 183 to come before this committee to be laying over for possible inclusion for an omnibus bill.
Very good, Representative Kiefer. We will certainly consider that. Proceed.
I would like to just quickly explain the bill. It's fairly easy to see that we're changing a little bit of language just to simply require teacher candidates to pass the basic skills exam before they actually are able to teach in the classroom with their license. I would be happy to answer
Representative
any
Kiefer,
questions.
You have some testifiers, do you not?
Yes,
so
I
let's
do.
Bring them to the table.
Okay, and I also have a letter in support from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce as well with Cecilia Rattel. I have Mr. Scott Kroonquist from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and Mr. Ron Hill is here, and he is representing the Board of Teaching.
Good morning, Mr. Kupkus. Please say your name for the record and begin telling us how much you like this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And we do support House File 183, and I will be brief as well. It's a pretty straightforward change. We think it's a reasonable expectation. You know all the research, the data, the statistics that points to the importance of the quality of the teacher in the classroom. In fact, the only thing more important, really, in student achievement is parental involvement. It's the single greatest factor inside the classroom is the quality of the teacher. So we think this is a reasonable expectation. Thank you.
And Mr. Hill.
Hi, my name is Ron Hill. And thank you for having me here, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The Board of Teaching has reviewed both this particular bill and the one that in the Senate committee. And we are in total support of the bill as it reads and everything. If you have any questions, you know, I'll stand for questions. As you all know, we recently moved from what was referred to as the Praxis test over to the METAL test last fall, and we are slowly getting information in on the METAL test and the results that our candidates are seeing in the passage in the individual licensure areas and in the basic skills testing area. However, we do not have a large number of takers just yet, as the bulk of people who take this test really appear in the months of April and May. And at that juncture, we'll have a number of test takers to review and everything. But we are in total support. We do have a legislative committee who has gone over the language in this bill, and we think it is an excellent move. The Board of Teaching is always very concerned about the tools that we have in place to ensure to our parents that we have the very best and the most effective teachers in all of our classrooms, and we believe this will be a step in that direction. So thank you.
Representative Mariani, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, my first question, I have a couple very quickly, is for Mr. Kronquist.
Mr. Kronquist, would you return, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Kronquist, explain this for us right now. So under the current procedure or process, a candidate takes the test, and my understanding is that they have 3 years in which to pass the test. So walk me through what might be a scenario with an individual who takes the test, doesn't pass the test. What is that person doing while they're preparing to pass the test next time around? Just paint a picture for us of what is that person not in the classroom? Is that person sent back to a college somewhere to study some more, or what's the reality on the ground?
Mr. Kronquist.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, and I'll actually defer to Mr. Hill because I think he knows much more than this, but my understanding is that that person can be in the classroom, but then does obviously needs to re-engage in remedial efforts to and needs to pass that test eventually.
So Representative Mariani.
And so then, thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps it might be good for Mr. Hill to jump in as well. So then what would change in regards to that classroom experience with this bill? Is that person now barred from being in the classroom until such time as they pass the test? Again, the reality ground, what would you expect that individual be doing? Because obviously you have an individual who's made a commitment to pursue a career in teaching, and then they run into this test. And I do want to ask Mr. Hill some questions about the test, but what would you reasonably expect that individual to be doing in this period of time?
Mr. Hill.
Thank you. Right now, the teachers, and there are not very many that fall into this category. Right now, those teachers are working on, if you want to use the word remediation or brushing up on the skills. Usually, the case is that they've only, failed one of the three tests, and they can work with their teacher preparation program that they came out of to go back there and get the skills necessary. However, I also know that the individual school districts are working with their teachers and giving them ideas as to what they might need to work on in order to improve on the skills in the particular test that they failed in. Yes, these teachers are in the classroom, and they have three attempts or 3 years in which to get or to obtain the passage of those tests and everything. With this bill, that would never even happen because they wouldn't even be able to set foot into the classroom unless they had passed the basic skills test.
And then, Madam
Representative Mariani
and Mr. Hill, and so they would not be able to step in the classroom even under the student teaching. Is that correct or not,
Mr. Hill?
That would be incorrect. I'm assuming okay. that yeah, because there may be some while they're student teaching and stuff like that, they may be taking the basic skills test at that juncture. But as a student teacher, yes, they would definitely have the ability to be in a classroom and not have passed the basic skills test at that juncture.
And Madam Chair, I appreciate your indulgence.
Absolutely.
And Mr. Hill, so let's just talk quickly about the test. And by the way, I support this effort. I think this is the right move. This is an issue that's been debated. You know, Representative Harrison, you know this was debated years ago. You and I were engaged in that, and it's been going around. And I think part of what this legislature has tried to struggle with is, a notion of, balancing out equity and fairness to, candidates who are pursuing in good intentions a career, but at the same time, obviously making sure that we have the highest quality instruction available to our students, and that becomes a more acute issue as we continue to face vital issues like the achievement gap. However, one of the things that we've also struggled with in recent years is the notion, the powerful notion that many of us on both sides of the aisle have criticized the NCLB approach to measurements, which is one test fixed in time, shall determine pretty effectively, in a high stakes way, everything that we should know about you. And I know that's extreme, but I mean, that's really the kind of pushback that's happening right now, is an understanding that perhaps a wiser approach is to have multiple measures of competency and apply them accordingly, both for teachers and students, as well as school systems. So tell me about the test itself, because obviously, there are some disparate outcomes when disaggregated by different types of teachers taking this test. And we all know that some people are just plain old good at tests, and some folks are not good at, certain types of tests. So tell me about this test, its evolution, and specifically tell us about the adjustments, if any, that have been made to be able to factor out test biases, which is pretty well documented in the field of sociology about tests as they apply to different individuals. So tell me, is that something that the board has struggled with, that has made adjustments for? How confident can you tell us that we now have a test that really minimizes this notion of test bias?
Mr. Hill.
Thank you for your question. Very important question. Because you are touching on an area that the board has discussed, and that is the disparity in the passage rates of individuals who take the basic skills test. When we moved to our new testing company, that was one of the things that we wanted to ensure that was going to be in place. Whether you use the words cultural sensitivity or having tests that are not biased, etc. Now, I am not I don't know that big word, psychometrician.
I can't say that word.
But I do know that there was some talk in regards to that when you folks, I think, met on January 27th and 28th. One of the things that we asked, and quite frankly, if I had to ask the testing company to do this, they certainly wouldn't be up to snuff in terms of being able to do the work that we do. But, for example, see, these are some of the things that the test company was required to do. Test, they cannot contain language or symbols that may reinforce stereotypes. Test will not contain inflammatory or highly controversial topics. Test will not contain inappropriate underlying assumptions. In particular, ethnocentric, elitist, and gender-based beliefs and language that are not germane to the domain being tested. There is a concept called differential item functioning, and I'm going to read this section to you because I understand it better read. An additional procedure performed by the testing company is to ensure fairness and cultural sensitivity in test development and scoring is the differential item functioning. DIT is an empirical measure based on the actual test performance of examinees in different groups. DIF occurs when people of approximately equal knowledge and skill in different groups perform in substantially different ways on a test question. Measures of DIF help to identify questions that may be biased because group differences in relevant knowledge and skill have been taken into account. So the test company is very much aware of this, and we are definitely want those biases, those cultural insensitivities, those inflammatory situations removed from the test. And so that's why it is going to be extremely interesting to the Board of Teaching as we get more test takers through the system, particularly in May, to see what are the outcomes. Now, you're referring to the demographics of the test takers. We are equally as anxious to see what the outcomes are for those applicants.
I have lots of questions, but I don't want to dominate the discussion.
Well, Representative Mariani, if you have, go ahead.
maybe just one last thing.
Sure, go ahead.
So then, Mr. Hill, what can you tell us about the pattern of results over time relative to disparities and test outcomes? Have we narrowed those now that we've got testing companies that are more acutely aware of, some of the old biases in these tests? Have they remained the same? Have they gotten worse in terms of disparate
Mr.
outcomes?
Hill.
Thank you for your question. I cannot answer for the historical, from the historical context, and I do not have the exact numbers in front of me. However, on the first time passage rates, or the test taker who's taking one of those three tests for the very first time, there is a, I'll say, a significant difference amongst the groups who pass the test. Don't quote me on this, and we'll supply with the number. But white test takers will pass first time all three tests at approximately 85 to 88%, right in that range, mm-hmm. and our test takers who are applicants of color are passing in the 65 to 70% range the first time they take that test, mm-hmm. and that is a concern. That's why we absolutely want to ensure that these tests are doing or are addressing the issues that you brought up. Another thing that's happening in this arena is, the Board of Teaching and other groups are working with the Bush Foundation in terms of candidates who are in all these programs. Do the candidates understand what kind of program are they coming into? Are we getting the right candidates in there? Are we keeping them in there, in the programs, et cetera? So there are multiple areas where people are checking to make sure, or not checking, but are checking and working with candidates to ensure that they can pass these tests. Having said all that, the Board of Teaching still wants the most effective and the best teachers out of these programs standing in front of our children.
Absolutely.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Mr. Hill. When I've talked to some teachers, when I tell them that this is in current statute, they don't believe me, because the teaching institution that they went to required that they had to take it before they could graduate and pass the test. So do you have a number of the teaching institutions that require them to pass the basic skills test before they graduate from their programs?
Mr. Hill.
I cannot answer that. I would defer. We do have Director Mielek here from the Department of Education. He might.
Yes, you're welcome to come down. I think we're still trying to find out that answer, but he will assure us that he will find out the answer. Ms. Ballmer's in Washington, D.C., and could not be here. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members, John Mielek, Minnesota Department of Education. I'm the Director of Educator Licensing. And the Board of Teaching is aware of a few colleges, I don't have a concrete number for you today, that do use the basic skills test passing the basic skills test as a requirement. The number has increased over the last couple of years, as Representative McFarland alluded to. There wasn't a lot of notice to this particular language in the past. As there has been an increased awareness of the language, colleges have been changing some of their practices. The institutions do report their requirements for the program in their institutional reports that the board receives. Unfortunately, the board's not summarized or aggregated that data, so there's not a clear way today to tell you how many colleges do require it and which way they do require it, but I do believe it is something that we're working on to get those numbers developed. So that's unfortunately not a great answer, but that's the best answer I have for you this morning.
Thank you. And why don't you stay at the table just in case we have more Representative McFarland?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess anecdotally I'm finding that a lot of the private colleges require that, just anecdotally.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the testifiers. I always think when we do legislation, kind of like with the medical practice, we should first do no harm, and then hopefully we're doing some good. And when we had Dr. Misty Sato here a couple weeks ago, she testified that these sorts of tests really don't have aren't an effective measure of teacher quality. And of course, teacher quality is what we're all trying to get at here, because we know that research shows that does make a big difference in our students' learning. So we're appreciate the discussion and the united goal of all of us for the teacher quality. But I, as I'm hearing Representative Mariani's comments and hearing about the disparate results on this test with teachers of color, it makes me think of some of the other efforts underway this session where we're trying to increase the number of teachers of color, because that can help address the achievement gap, and that is something we know does address the achievement gap. So I'm wondering if I could hear some assurance from any of the three of you that this will not do harm. If it doesn't, you know, really research shows that this test is really an effective measure of teacher quality, and then if it lowers the number of teachers of color, which does help with the achievement gap, assure me this bill isn't doing any harm.
Mr. Hill or Representative Kiefer?
I'll answer. I'm not sure we can assure that, but we heard a couple weeks ago from Representative Moran that we cannot wait. The achievement gap needs to be addressed now. And we've heard over and over again in this committee that it's so important to raise the bar, not only for our students, but for our teachers. And this bill has bipartisan support. It was brought up last year in the Senate by Senator Bonoff. It's when we don't address this issue of teachers not being able to pass a basic skills test, it actually hindered our chances of getting any Race to the Top money last year. So I don't see how this could be a step backwards in what our goal is to improve the excellence in education in Minnesota. Does that answer your question? Or?
Representative Moran, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to say I do support having the best teachers in the classroom, but I think we also must address if the test itself has great disparities in it. We must work to ensure that it is not biased or it's at a place that is ensuring the success of all the teachers that are taking the test. So it may be some work that needs to be done within the testing and the outcomes of the test. But I do agree, we need great teachers in the class.
And I just want to point out from what we were reading before that it goes on that there was a report to the legislature in 1994 on cultural sensitivity, and the following organizations were consulted in the testing: the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans, Council of Black Minnesotans, Minneapolis Public Schools, Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, Minnesota Education Association, Minnesota Federation of Teachers, Minnesota Indian Scholarship Committee, St. Paul Public Schools, and Spanish-Speaking Affairs Council.
Representative Greiling, to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, back to my question. I'd like the other testifiers to answer it. Do you, what can you show me that's evidence that this is a effective measure of teacher quality? And also, we did have some of us that were in the legislature last year, I think over the fall, had some concerns expressed to us from the colleges and universities that the Board of Teaching may have set the cut score too high, which would exacerbate these the gate of teacher candidates for teachers of color with the current test results.
Mr. Hill, do you want to start with that?
Yes, thank you for your question. You know, I can't provide, you know, hard data. A teacher has a degree from an institute of higher education from their college preparatory program. A teacher passes a set of basic skills tests, a content test, a pedagogy series of tests and everything. None of those will guarantee or assure that that person is going to be an effective teacher once they set foot in the classroom. We are working towards that. You've all heard information around the teacher performance assessment program that, you know, that we are moving towards. All I can say is rest assured that the Board of Teaching would not adopt anything that would lessen any particular individual's chance in relation to their demographic or their status in terms of color, in terms of getting into and being part of a teaching program. What was the second part of your question?
Representative Greiling, the second part of your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Hill. I'm wondering what evidence you have, given that Dr. Sato said there wasn't any, that this is an effective measure of teacher quality, and then also what assurance can you give me that this won't exacerbate the number of teachers of color in the field, given that the concern from the colleges and universities last fall was that the Board of Teaching set the cut scores too high, which exacerbates the problem with the current difference in outcomes. We have an achievement gap in our teacher candidates between white teachers and teachers of color as well.
Mr. Hill.
The setting of the cut scores last fall, let me back up a little bit. When the tests were benchmarked and all of the educators who participated in the process of establishing these tests in the area of content and pedagogy, we heard from them. We heard, you know, from the testing, that the testing company itself, and then they come forward with a recommendation as to cut scores, and then they give us, you know, standard deviations that we can move in one direction or the other from the cut scores and everything. The cut scores, you know, the Board of Teaching essentially moved the cut scores over one standard deviation in just about all of the categories. Mm-hmm. And will that action in and of itself create better teachers? No. But will it potentially, you know, it'll cause a change in the attitude and type of teachers that may look at or, you know, enter into the profession or go, to, you know, go through the teacher preparation program. For the board, it's simply a matter of this is one piece, one step of helping to, and I don't like the word ensure, but help address having, you know, the right kind of teacher in a classroom. Again, I'll go back to, there is no one particular test, no one particular class, no one particular program that will provide a guarantee that you know, things are going to get better. There is as much done at the school district level to ensure the success of effective teachers in the classroom as there are in probably, you know, in what the Board of Teaching does in terms of what the college teacher preparatory programs do. So everybody has got their hand on the pulse of, you know, what it takes to become an effective teacher. And, you know, right down to what's being done in the school district, there is as much being done there in terms of ensuring that as what the board does, as what the college preparatory, you know, programs do, et cetera. In no way is this meant to look like people are being, you know, locked out of or eliminated from a program. It is just one piece to help ensure that we are getting effective people, getting or effective teachers, you know, into the classroom.
And members, my recollection is that the basic skills test is just that. It is basic. It is ensuring that our teacher candidates have a grasp of language, that they understand language, they understand how to articulate ideas in the multiple choice questions that they're challenged with. And Representative Kiefer, do they have any short answer questions? Because all these tests, as I recall, can all be taken online, correct?
That's correct, Chair. And I believe you might have some sample questions in your packet today. I also wanted to mention that currently this is affecting about 100 teacher candidates. So it's not a huge number. And it's not that we want to exclude them. We would definitely want them to reach that bar. We just don't want to lower the bar.
Representative Griley.
Can I hear from the Department of Education, too, please? Thank you.
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, representatives, the Board of Teaching, when they're setting the test scores, do look at a broad degree of information. They look at how different groups are performing by ethnicity, by gender, and they look at the basic skill sets. They look at the content test, the pedagogy test, and they are able to make shifts in their score-setting process if they see demographics not scoring well on a particular section of an examination or an entire group of an examination. So they do use that information in their process for setting the test scores. I do think that if Karen Blommer were here today, she would let you know that the tests aren't a particular measure of effectiveness in the classroom. And that's why they're looking at the TPA and going to multiple measures of looking at a candidate when they come out. I think for a number of years, people have stated that the license in of itself, when I've graduated, isn't an indication that I'm going to be successful in the classroom. It's an indication that I've had processes and procedures and training to have the best chance for success when I get into the classroom. But ultimately, when I get into the classroom, there's other factors that impact my effectiveness, such as induction and mentoring and a number of other things that go on. It's one piece of ensuring that that teacher is going to be successful.
Mr. Hill.
And then just on specifically the basic skills tests themselves, under the old Praxis system, we were never able to really get our arms around what does the test represent. Is it what your knowledge level would be at the end of high school? Is it equivalent to an ACT test in those areas of reading, writing, math? So when this particular, the metal tester started up, it was asked to, we asked them to benchmark the basic skills test around what a college-ready teacher might look like.
Representative Griling, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be my last statement now, not a question. I guess I'm struggling with this because we're going in the direction of the TPA and we're going in the direction of multiple measures. And, of course, you know, this is probably by most considered an easy test. But it's kind of like, you know, the math test that we had with the grad, and we ended up thinking it wasn't quite so easy when we looked at who wasn't passing it and that it was a one test or off with your head. And I see this now doing the same thing to teacher candidates, kind of flying in the face of the idea that teacher quality is measured in many ways. And I hope we don't do some harm and gate out some very fine teachers that on other measures might be stars. And this, now they're not going to be allowed in the classroom at all. I guess they could take the test, keep taking it and trying to pass it. But I'm struggling with this.
Representative Kath.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions, I think, that initially goes to Mr. Hill. First off, with the new test, the medal, I believe, is what it's called, how long has it been given, and how many candidates do we know have taken this?
Mr. Hill.
Thank you for the question. The first test were administered back in September, I believe.
Correct.
And the Board of Teaching saw some of the first results at our December meeting, and we did not have very many test takers that time. For example, in each of the licensure areas, well over half of licensure areas, we didn't even have test takers yet. But in the ones that we did, it would be like 5 to 10. And in the basic skills areas, I think they had some of the higher number of takers, and that might have been like 20 to 30 candidates. So we are, anxiously, awaiting the results that come this May when we do get a large influx of test takers.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hill, yeah, question I have then is, would you say that the medal test is more difficult, about the same standard as the Praxis? What would your take be on this exam as compared to the Praxis that we had been administering?
Mr. Hill.
It was asked as the, in working with the test company and working with the individuals who helped, who went through the process of establishing the questions, et cetera, to bring the rigor that a classroom teacher would expect. In other words, we had classroom teachers in all the subject areas who sat down when they created these tests, created the questions, they vetted the questions, et cetera, and they were asked, they were not told to make the rigor higher or harder than what the Praxis test was. They were told, you're the teacher, you know what rigor is required in order for a teacher to stand in front of a classroom. That's the kind of, and that's where the source for as to the level of rigor went in. It was the actual classroom teachers who participated in the establishment, of the tests, et cetera.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Kath.
Were those same individuals then the ones that set the cut scores?
Mr. Hill.
It was that same group. What they did is there was a very elaborate process the testing company went through. If I had a subject area that had 10 teachers sitting there, they received a questionnaire that they could not share with each other in terms of this is going a little bit beyond my scope here, but they might take a question and say, it asked the 10 people that sat on a committee for that particular subject area, how many, if a student was to take or answer this question, how many would get it correct? And so they would take that response across all the areas and everything. And so it wasn't like, let's take a vote. What do you think the passage rate should be on this particular question? You know, they took anonymous results from each of the teacher and then aggregated those. Does that help at all?
Absolutely. Madam Chair?
Yes.
And beyond that then, you even took it one step further to say that you even went and increased standard deviation from that,
yes,
from what the recommendation was.
Yes.
On each area of the test?
Mr. Hill.
It wasn't on all tests. I could defer to, we have another Board of Teaching member, because I just don't, we did it on quite a few of the tests, not all of the tests.
Madam Chair, I guess my line of questioning comes from the fact that I took the Praxis, and I remember taking the Praxis, and it was a basic skills test that I was able to meet and was something very simple. But ironically, my sister just took the medal test just a couple months ago. She's 2 years older than myself, has decided she wants to go into the teaching profession, and she said it was an extremely, extremely difficult exam, and one that she is surprised that as a basic standard to enter into the teaching profession that she was put to. And she said, now, the test that you took, is this what this looked like? And I said, no, not at all. And she said, and what was ironic to her is there is absolutely no study materials in which to prepare yourself for this test either. And I think that's something that we have to look at here. She is a graduated magna cum laude from college, and she looked at this and said, this is a very high bar to set just for admission, you know, into to a classroom. And when I saw this bill coming forward, I think that's something we have to focus on here, is this metal test, you know, because the data that you have, Representative Kiefer, goes back to the Praxis. And when it was the Praxis, I can see some of this, because I remember taking it, and to tell you the truth, there's some real good points there. But this metal test, I don't think it has been tested enough yet to say, are we ready to say that those cut scores are at the point that is a measurement of how basic, you know, a teacher needs to be before they enter into that classroom. So I guess that's where my hesitation lies right now, and I guess I would like to see where this test goes here in May and see some of the data and where it's coming from. And anecdotally, hearing from some teachers saying, we should watch this, because this is a new test, and it is very different than the one that I remember taking as a teacher candidate.
Mr. Hill.
I want to clarify now, we're talking two sets of tests here. This bill is talking about the basic skills
test,
and you know, I am not addressing pedagogy and content, licensure areas and everything. And again, I'll go back to the basic skills test. We asked them to benchmark them at
college ready.
College ready.
Yes.
And that would be, you know, from the Board of Teaching's perspective, I mean, that's a pretty sound place to start from in terms of where an individual should be at if they want to pursue, you know, this particular area.
And Mr. Hill, on the committee that helped set the cut score, teachers were involved, correct?
Well, it was the teachers that actually, you know, like that one exercise described, you know, they did that with every question.
Yes.
Every question they
As I sat on those committees, Mr. Representative Kath, and we have very extensive discussions. And when I served on the Board of Teaching, I served on that particular committee and worked with teachers. And for the most part, they felt that the final cut score that was set was too low. And of course, that's a few years ago, more than a dozen years ago. But you know, we're moving forward with a higher expectation.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, and I think that that's a good statement, but I think we also heard here today that they set it a full standard deviation higher than what was recommended by, I believe, the teachers on the committee. So what I'm saying is that I think we have just increased the bar even higher than the people that were on that committee. And so the recommendations that you offered, you know, a dozen years ago or more was not what they followed with this new test. And I think that's where my concern is saying, are we putting forward a piece of legislation here that really hasn't tested the results of the new test that we've got there? If this was about the Praxis, we've got plenty of years to measure that and to really look at this. But right now, this is a brand new exam, and I'm hearing from people, and one being, you know, my sister, saying that, my goodness, I'm a good parent and I'm a good teacher candidate. I'm some that you want in these schools. And right now, she's saying by 2 points on one of the tests, she passed it, and she had a 4.0 GPA in those courses in college. So I look at it and say, is this truly a good measurement right now? And I'm saying we should just hold off to find out what these cut scores, so we can actually see a diverse perspective, because I'm a little cautious about the number of test scores that you got in December, I believe, is when you said you saw the first round of these scores come
Mr.
forward.
Mr. Hill.
The Board of Teaching has made a firm commitment to reviewing all these test scores a year from last fall for the very concerns that you're raising. But again, today we're talking about the basic skills test, which were the what we expect a college-ready student to possess and this is what they should possess at the start of or the very beginning of their college career. Hopefully, they would far exceed that as they, you know, graduated 4 years later. But just to reference the pedagogy and the content test. The board is definitely aware of, you know, their change in the cut score status that they've set, and they are fully prepared to, you know, if necessary, you know, to make modifications. But that would be in consultation, you know, with the testing company and with a number of groups who participated in the starting of that process. As those cut scores, or not cut scores, but as we received information about the process, and et cetera, you know, part of the board's thinking when they looked at some of the scores, when they looked at some of the item banks and the recommendations, I don't want to say recommendations, but because they weren't recommendations, again, teachers, it was an anonymous poll of, for example, 10 teachers as to how they thought if a person with a certain level of knowledge would do on this particular test. And in some instances, you know, it was below 50%. And it was just very difficult, you know, for the board of teaching to say, not only for themselves, but you know, for the public as they look at these tests, to say that a passage rate of 50% or less on the number of items or questions that were in that bank was acceptable. You know, when most of the parents say, look, you know, and not just parents but teachers, are, when they look at things, you know, when they see or think passage rate, you know, they're thinking, you know, 70%. Generalization about passage rates or anything. So, but again, basic skills test versus content and pedagogy test, the board is fully committed to looking at and reviewing the content and pedagogy test. As a matter of fact, it's less than a year now. It's going to be coming up you know, in October, November. We're going to be taking a look at those. And if they also need to be fine-tuned, you know, that will be done.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. We have to move on, committee. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to the basic skills test and ask a question related to that, but the praxis changed into the metal. That's different than the basic. So I'm assuming knowledge has changed over time, or at least the need for particular knowledge changed over time. How, to what extent, if any, has the basic skills test changed over a period of 5 to 10 to 15 years, Mr. Hill,
Mr.
if at all?
Mr. Hill, or?
I'm going to defer to
Mr. Mielek. Maybe you could help us out.
Madam Chair, members. It's difficult to compare the two tests. They come from two different vendors with completely different styles. The Praxis series was designed by ETS, the Educational Testing Services, and it was a national test. And they aligned that. Minnesota had to say, okay, which test best aligns with what we want to measure? What test best looks like what Minnesota teachers deserve and should answer? Whereas the MTLE was designed by Pearson, and what Pearson does is comes in and designs the tests around the state standards, and the state's allowed to say this is what we believe teachers in Minnesota need to know. And that's where the MTLE, as Mr. Hill was referring to, has been designed in the basic skills test to test a college readiness. With the Praxis series, we didn't have that same assurance. It was couldn't draw a benchmark as to is it college readiness, is it equivalent to an ACT, what does it look like? And that's a lot to do with the fact that it was a national test that we were adopting for Minnesota purposes, whereas the new test has been designed to be a college readiness test.
Representative Barrett.
Let me restate my question. The basic test is different than the metal and the praxis, correct?
Representative Barrett, the medal has replaced the Praxis yes. as the basic skills
Got
test,
it.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, then. A follow-up question for that, then. It is very important for us to gauge the effectiveness or the at least the ability of a teacher coming from college going into teaching. To what extent is that same philosophy put forth towards teachers who have been in the classroom for a period of time? Wouldn't that same necessity hold true, especially if the information in these tests change over a period of time? And that knowledge would be new then to someone who hasn't yet to take a test with that particular knowledge in the test.
Mr. Mielek, you have the institutional memory, so why don't you answer that?
Madam Chair, members, that's a great question and a fair question. One of the things that we've done as a state is when we change requirements, we've not gone back and enforce a new requirements on practicing teachers. We hold them harmless. So, for example, when we switched the licensure fields in the early 2000s, we had hundreds of licensure fields that we narrowed down to about 50 licensure fields. And we didn't go back and say, okay, you've been teaching 712 English for the past 15, 20 years. You now have to go back and earn a 512 Communication Arts and Literature license. We said, we'll grandfather you and you can continue teaching in that scope alone. You can't teach everything that the 512 license in the Communication Arts and Literature does, but you can continue in the field in which you had your preparation. And so the testing has continued to be the same philosophy. We've not gone back and required the teachers who are in the field to take the new test because they documented the standards they needed to document at the time that they were licensed.
Thank you.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a real quick question and a clarification for the author. I think it's important for the record that we understand, and you, I'm going to ask you the question, you tell me, that the testing that you're requesting and the passing of the test is basic, is a basis for licensure and not for candidate acceptance into a program. Is that correct?
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Debke. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that actually kind of gets back to my question was following Representative McFarland's earlier. But, you know, I think we're all having a really interesting discussion here, and it's important information. Your bill is very simple and just says we want the students, the candidates, to pass the test. And we're getting into what test is it, and I think that's a whole different question and a very important one, but the bill itself I'm perfectly comfortable in supporting. I think this is just one measure, and not necessarily a measure of quality, but a baseline for students, for teachers, for candidates to be able to enter our classrooms. And I really appreciate the discussion on test bias, and I'm very happy to hear that you're going to address some of that. You know, as a parent, as a legislator, as a citizen, I want teachers in the classroom that have proper grammar, that can speak and be a role model for the students in their classroom. I want teachers who can read for comprehension themselves in order to teach that to their students. And I think that's what this is getting at, is that we want that basic set of knowledge in our teachers before they enter the classroom. So I'm perfectly comfortable with that. I guess one of the points that came up that I think we need to talk about a little bit, or I guess I'm asking you to comment on and see if you can collect, is we've been talking a lot in this committee about raising the bar in our colleges and in the outputs, and we've talked with the Bush folks, and they're going to guarantee students with a certain level. And as I said, it gets back to Representative McFarland, in that why don't we place the onus back on the colleges to guarantee that the students that they graduate to apply for licensure have already passed this test? If we're really talking about colleges doing the guaranteeing, why don't we push it back there rather than have it be post-graduation? And the piece that I didn't hear from you that maybe you can answer is, as you're collecting this data, and it sounds like you have a lot of it but haven't disaggregated it, can you currently look back at the Praxis or the new metal test and say which schools are producing students that can actually pass this test, and are there some that don't? And are now the schools that are doing this pilot for Bush doing that, are they going to adopt it as part of their graduation requirement, and are the students from those colleges passing where other colleges that aren't participating?
Mr. Mielek. To the extent you can answer that. Excellent question, Representative Norton. It is, but Madam I don't Chair, know if he can answer that.
Madam Chair, board members, current system that we have, and Karen Ballmer always says that we're data rich and access poor. We have a lot of data, but it's not submitted in ways or used in ways to really tell us a lot. And so one of the things that the board is working on is a new data collection system. She's been very actively engaged in working with the department in designing a new tool that colleges can submit more information. And part of their PERCA system, where they're redesigning the institutional approval process, will be collecting more data in useful ways so they can start to answer some of those questions. As of right now, I don't believe there is a way that we can look or compare institution to institution specific to passage scores on, for example, the basic skills test. So I don't think that there is a way today.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I do have some information here. This is from the Board of Teaching, and it gives test scores from 2001 to 2009, and it does compare everything. It's got schools, Augsburg, it just names each school and what their pass rates are. I'll just give a shout out to Carleton. Looks like they have 100% pass rates. And I want to also thank Representative Norton for bringing us full circle, and that's exactly what I was thinking, is we're really getting off on a tangent in this conversation. Mm-hmm. We're simply asking that the teachers
before license
test before they are alone in the classroom teaching our students. And that's all we're asking, is just to raise the bar a little bit.
Members, we have to move on because we have another bill, and I think that we've heard a really good discussion. And feel free to attend the Board of Teaching meetings. There is a luncheon that we've been invited to on Friday. I hope that you RSVP to Karen Ballmer if you're going to attend. And thank you, Mr. Mielek and Mr. Hill. Excellent. Representative Kiefer renews her motion that this bill be placed as a possibility for, yes, be laying over for inclusion, possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Very quickly, if I may, I'm going to vote for the bill to move on.
The bill is just being laying over.
Well, I'm going to vote to eventually for it to move on, but I do want to say that very quickly, because we did move this last year also out of this committee. I don't want senators to get all the credit for moving things around this legislature. But I do want to say that this, I think, has been a very important conversation.
Yes.
I really appreciate that you vetted it, because if it doesn't happen at this committee, members, it ain't going to happen anywhere else in the legislature. You know, this is it. And at the end of the day, I think it's really important that the tail not wag the dog, that we don't have testing companies determine what our desired outcomes are, that we don't even have small groups out there. That's our job. That's our responsibility. And so, Madam Chair, I appreciate the depth of the discussion. And Representative Kiefer, you were put through baptism through fire here, but I would really strongly encourage you to connect back with the Department of Education, because I think the Commission is going to have some really strong thoughts about perhaps some ways to maybe tweak and restructure this bill. So that's my advice to you. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
Thank you. Representative Kiefer and gentlemen.
Committee members, our next bill is being presented by Representative Erickson, House File 300, and it's regarding comprehensive eye exams.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to move House File 300 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, House File 300 is an opportunity for parents. As you know, one of the legs of the stool, of my three-legged stool, which is the image we're using this session, is parents. And this is an opportunity for parents to find out at that initial time when their children are screened through the early childhood program what kinds of vision problems they might have. This will be somewhat controversial, and I want to assure anyone who is opposed to this that if we do decide to include this in the omnibus reform bill, that we will certainly make sure it is not a mandate and that it is an opportunity for parents to know a little bit more about their children's vision to the extent that we can find that out at that early stage. Members, I've been interested in vision therapy for a number of years. In 1979, when I was teaching, Right to Read was very active across this nation. It was the premier program for literacy in our state. And I was at the time teaching reading and English at both the high school and junior high levels, and determined that some of my students had issues with their vision that I couldn't help them with. I watched them as they read, and I saw them skipping lines. I saw them going back. I saw them reading single words instead of phrases. So I went to my reading director and asked him what we could do. And interestingly enough, he was working with Dr. Greenfield at the Department of Education, Al Greenfield, and they were seeing this need across the state as well to address issues with reading that were not comprehension, were not fluency, but were related to vision. And so my reading director in Princeton launched a program called Vision Therapy. And I went to work for him after school and on Saturdays to help these students. Actually, I didn't go to work for him right away. I volunteered. And they devised exercises, he and Dr. Greenfield and some others in this state, optometrists, ophthalmologists. This has a rich beginning and is
popular in some areas of the nation today, to the extent that if you go on the web, you can find lots of interesting things about vision therapy, and we have today with us some experts in this area. But it's simply an opportunity for parents to know whether or not their children have needs beyond that initial 20/20 vision test that's provided by our nurses. And in fact, I think our nurses could easily provide this test for our children. But I had amazing results. I have to tell you, in the 3 years that I worked this program, because I worked it in, actually started getting paid for it, $10 a lesson. It was an hour-long lesson in 1980, 81, and 82. And then our reading director moved on to a different school district, and I moved on to the high school only. I did no longer teach also in the junior high schools, so I kind of moved away from the program and had other assignments that were taking my time. But I did call Dr. Nelson last night. He's in Arizona, and he was delighted to hear that this might be something that could become reality, because he's worked for so many years to try to help parents know that there is an opportunity out there for them to help their children. In fact, I was visiting with Catherine Kirsten the other day, and you, most of you know that she is a well-known columnist, or was, for the Star Tribune, and one of her sons went through this program, or a program similar to this, and she said it had amazing results. She also has a daughter who, you know, this program didn't help, but had other issues, and they resolved some of those vision issues too. So with that said, I would like to turn over testimony to my experts who are here, and please introduce yourselves for the record so they know who's talking and know that you're valid.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sue Hawk, and I am president and co-founder of the Minnesota Vision Coalition. I am also a parent of two children, and I also work full-time, took time off today to be here to talk to you about this very, very important issue that's concerning children, their vision, and the effects that vision has on their learning. Today I've got a couple folks with me, Ron Sheik and Dr. Trent Cole. So again, the Minnesota Vision Coalition is made up of parents, teachers, associations, and organizations that are focused on advocating for our children, specifically focused on their vision and the effects that it can have on their learning. There are staggering facts that you will hear, as well as a story that I will tell you about my daughter. So like I said, I'm a parent, two children. My daughter is 21 now, and I have a son who's 17. Let me give you just a little bit of background as to why the Minnesota Vision Coalition was formed. My daughter, Ashley, struggled in school for many, many years. I'm sure you all have children, may have similar stories as well, but she struggled for many, many years. In junior high, she failed many classes. I worked with her teachers, I worked with the counselors, and you know, we worked on different things, but she failed them and she had to make them up. Once she got into senior high, again, continued failing. She worked really hard. We didn't understand what the problem was. We continued to work with her teachers, and she had to make those classes up. Finally, we took her to get a comprehensive eye exam, and Dr. Trent Cole saw her, and what he identified was that she had a major vision disorder that affected her learning. Bottom line, her eyes were not working together. I could not believe that what he was telling me, that in some cases her eyes, when she was 16 years old, her eyes were operating at a seven-year-old level. 7 years old. She's a junior in high school. How on earth can, if your eyes are working at a seven-year-old level, how on earth can anybody succeed and move forward? So when he told me that, I was stunned. It's like, how can this be? She had vision screenings, had passed them, but she still had this major vision disorder. How on earth could this occur? So I asked Dr. Cole to help me and say, this cannot happen to another child. It cannot happen to other families. We need to make a change. Will you help me? And so at that point in time, the Minnesota Vision Coalition was formed, and that was about 4 years ago. I want to take just a couple minutes and talk about some of the facts that are out there that are surrounding this. And it is, I believe you have copies of it, and I'm not going to run through all of it. But I just want to point out a couple of facts. So according to the Vision and Learning Organization, 80% of learning is visual. So your kids, my kids, Minnesota kids, when they're going into these schools, everything is based upon that their visual system and how good and effective it is and whether it works for them. Also, according to the Vision and Learning Organization, 1 in 4 children, 25%, have a vision problem that affects their learning. 1 in 4. There are other impacts as well that are stated there as far as economic impacts, self-esteem, economic impacts of more than $68 billion that is identified through the National Eye Institute and National Institute of Health. So there's staggering facts that are out there. I'm not going to go into any more of the details there. Our current statute today, 121A.17, states that children need to have a development screening before they enter school, which includes a vision screening. There are stats out there, according to the National Institute of Health and the Vision and Preschooler Study, that say vision screenings miss up to 60% of children who have a vision problem. 60%. And our kids are going through this vision screening today before they start school. So it is a fact that our vision screenings are not the same as comprehensive eye exams. Dr. Trenkel is going to talk just briefly about that, but bottom line, vision screenings check to see if you can see letters over there. Comprehensive eye exams check a lot more than that. So my question to all of you is, what can we do to help our Minnesota children so that we don't have the same situation that happened to Ashley, Rebecca, a gal I work next to who's got a fourth grader whose eyes are operating, or she's at a first grade comprehension level? What can we do to help our children? Our bill today is focused on making sure that we tell our Minnesota parents that vision screenings are not a substitute for a comprehensive eye exam. We just want to tell them. It is our right to tell them that they're not the same, and that we need to make sure that they know that. So if they want to go and get a comprehensive eye exam, they can.
So we have to move on.
Okay. Okay. So just to finish up, so I'm very, very concerned about this. We need to make sure that we can make a change here moving on, and hope that you will support us as we move on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. I just want to remind our testifiers that we do also have people, that we have about 4 people yet to speak, and we have a little less than 20 minutes left, so we want to make sure. Yes, and I also want to have time for questions, so please be as brief as possible in your comments. Thank you very much.
My name is Dr. Trent Cole, Madam Chair and members. As an eye care provider, the thing I'm most concerned about is the lack of awareness of visual health and what it means to our society. It's imperative that education occurs, that individuals understand that a screening and a comprehensive eye exam are different in nature. A screening will only check distance vision, where a comprehensive eye exam, we can look at developmental history, we can look at refractive status, eye teaming skills, ocular health, and we can also look at vision deficits as far as processing information. As Sue was saying, 80% is learning, 25% of individuals out there have difficulties. And stats are showing that our screenings are becoming less effective because we're not doing as many of them. Some of the screening programs out there aren't as comprehensive as they need to be. Now, opponents will get up here and they will tell you that the screenings are being completed the way that they should be. But what happens is, especially if you look at a school situation with nurses, they're being put under budget constraints, staffing issues, where things are not getting done as well as what they would want them to get done because of the time constraints. The Minnesota 2008-2020 survey of school nurses found that 80% of them said that they were underfunded for being able to put programs in. And what happens is, if they don't have enough nurses, they will call in parent volunteers to come in to help with the screening programs, untrained parent volunteers. And so putting the
the eye health in hands that may not completely understand what they're screening for and looking for is kind of the juxta of the problem that we're having. At this point in time, other opponents will come up here and tell you that we're trying to incur increased medical costs by trying to increase the number of eye exams that we want to do out there. Madam Chair and members, I ask you to look at the bill. We're not asking for that. We're asking for purely public education to understand that there's a difference between vision screening and a comprehensive eye exam. Many people come into me and say, I just had an eye exam last year at the driver's license place. It is not the same thing. We need to educate the population. Proponents and other eye care providers may come in and say that this is self-serving to try to get more comprehensive eye exams out there. And you are right. My job and my oath is to make sure that every child has the ability in the state of Minnesota to see and to learn in the school districts. And if that means we have to do eye exams on them, we need to do eye exams on them, or at least create the public awareness that it's not the same as a screening. I hold in front of you two position statements from the Academy of Ophthalmology that basically state, number one, that vision can interfere with the process of learning, and routine pediatric vision screenings are unlikely to disclose difficulties with near vision problems, convergence insufficiency, and some eye diseases out there. They also state in there that missing these problems can cause long-term consequences from assigning children to incorrect treatments, educational and medical. So we can ascertain from this that they even claim that the vision is so important to our learning and our learning abilities. The second portion of this is that they state that vision is good for essential proper physical development and growing children and learning. I agree. It goes on to state that further examining screens, let me back up, that routine comprehensive professional eye examinations of normal asymptomatic child has no proven benefit. I disagree with that. Sometimes children will not understand what asymptomatic is. So it's important to understand that wellness benefit checks are out there to ensure that our children have the proper utensils to do what they need to do. So,
thank you, Mr. Sheik. And I believe... Oh, I'm sorry.
Dr. Cole.
Okay. And we have a third testifier. Would you please say your name and for the record, please?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, my name is Ron Sheik. I'm a parent and also a past school board member for the district that I live in. I'm going to be very brief, but hopefully I can make my point very clearly. 10 years ago, this makes an anniversary for our family where my daughter wrote a note in her journal that said, my parents think I'm stupid. And that event in our life pushed us to find out why, when our daughter passed vision screening and was able to continue through school and only not even read at grade level, third grade, failing comprehension, that we stumbled on a possible solution, because that morning before breakfast, I read the homework that she had to do to her, because we were in a hurry to get her off to school. She was excited. She came home and she said, Dad, I passed the test. She had not passed the test before that. Excuse me. As a school board member, I helped parents who had similar situations with their children. And I asked them, I said, have you had a comprehensive eye exam? I would have used at that time eye exam. And they said, well, no, my child passed the vision screening test. I'm going, I don't think they're the same. I said, I encourage you to see your eye doctor. And so there were several families that helped through the system like that. And then, just in closing, it was two days ago, I got a text from my daughter that she's in college now. She got a B.
Thank you, Mr. Sheik, for your testimony. And we all appreciate what it means to be a parent and to work our way through difficult problems in our children's lives. So we appreciate you coming and having the courage to talk to us today. We do have two people that are Yeah, opposing the bill, and I'd like to have Dr. Botham come up, who's a pediatric ophthalmologist from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Botham. And we have about 10 minutes left before the end of committee. Just wanted to let you know. Thank you very much. And make sure that you speak clearly into the microphone.
Thank you.
Yes, I will.
Madam Chair and committee members, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to be here. I am a Minnesota parent. I have four kids of my own. I grew up with a dad who was a teacher. And I think because of that influence, when I decided to go into ophthalmology, decided I wanted to be in education, and so I work as a pediatric ophthalmologist at the University of Minnesota. Not only educate the future eye care providers in Minnesota, but do research and every day see kids. And there is nothing that pulls my heartstrings more as an eye care provider than hearing stories like that. I saw four kids yesterday that were picked up by screening endeavors. One was a six-week-old baby who was picked up because of Minnesota Department of Health regulations on what a primary doc should be doing, and has glaucoma. Blinding disorder. Kids get glaucoma too. And we're bringing that child to surgery tomorrow to try to help that child. A two-year-old child I saw yesterday had a comprehensive eye exam 6 months ago and was normal. Because of ongoing screenings, it was detected now, 6 months later, that he has bilateral cataracts at the age of two. Kids get cataracts too. And we're working to try to remedy that. I had a four-year-old yesterday that was screened and found to have astigmatism, and we're still working on whether or not it's enough to affect the vision development, and he may get glasses. I had a seven-year-old yesterday who's been screened many times and had an eye exam in the past, who has learning-related problems, and because of ongoing reading trouble, is back having a full eye exam. No matter what you do, there are kids, no matter how many tests you instill, there are kids in the system that needs something more than screening. And our guidelines that the state of Minnesota have had in place for many, many years on screening is mirrored in all the other areas of health that we're trying to screen for, hearing, development, whatever you might choose. And the children that fail a screening need a comprehensive eye exam. The public needs to know that there is a difference between screening and eye exams. But of the reasons specifically stated why a child needs something more than a vision screening exam include anything in the history that's a concern, anything in the past medical history that puts a child at risk, anything in the family history that puts a child at risk, and a concern from the parent. So hearing about children that went on for years and years where an environment wasn't giving them the message that they needed something more than screening is a concern. But that's really a different issue. And included in that, it's really a different issue as to whether or not how we're putting our arms around children that have reading-related challenges. That's a different issue than whether or not we should mandate comprehensive screening as a society to a group of people. I've been involved in the screening efforts through the Minnesota Department of Health. Our Department of Health has used a mandate from the state for screening and implemented and refined our programs. Through that, we have a work group that comes together with optometrists, with ophthalmologists, with the school nurses, and we refine, update, and continue to enhance our program here in the state. And certainly through that effort, we have a screening program in the state of Minnesota that isn't perfect. Comprehensive eye exams are not perfect. My eye exams that I did yesterday in clinic are not perfect. But the reason that makes vision screening so important is it's not just one exam. The two-year-old that had cataracts in my clinic yesterday had a normal exam 6 months ago. The seven-year-old that's struggling reading had a normal eye exam 2 years ago. And the reason that screening is so critical, and the reason it gets undermined as studies compare screening versus comprehensive exams, is they miss the point. Screening is not about comparing how good is an eye exam to screening at one time. No study has compared a lifetime of screening, a screening program from birth all the way up through, to a one-time comprehensive eye exam.
Dr. Botham, I apologize for interrupting you. We do need to wrap up your testimony.
So.
I do have one other testifier as well.
I will do so. So certainly, through all of this efforts, it's the opinion of a number of organizations that moving in the direction to mandate eye exams, knowing that there's only state funds that are going towards catching children, the more you put into a one-time exam, the less you have to spread over and potentially do more exams for many kids on a serial basis. With that, there's certainly plenty of stats out there when you look at the expense going into comprehensive eye exams versus screening. You can make estimates that screening is about $15 per kid, and eye exams maybe close to 100. So just in the age group alone, with between 60,000 and 70,000 children in Minnesota, you're talking about a $5 million difference. What we could do to screen more kids with $5 million is important.
Thank you very much, Dr. Botham. I'm sorry to cut you short. We do need to get one other testifier here.
Okay. I look forward to that testimony, along with just saying that the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'm closing, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, pediatricians, ophthalmologists, pediatric ophthalmologists, school nurses, American Academy of Family Practitioners all support vision screening for merits that are based in evidence on how we catch kids and helping kids in Minnesota grow up to see our great state.
Thank you very much. Our next testifier is Ann Hoxie, and she's with the School Nurses Organization of Minnesota. Thank you very much, Ms. Hoxie. We have about 4 minutes before the committee is adjourning, so please make your comments brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ann Hoxie, and I represent the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota. And I would really like to piggyback on what our pediatric ophthalmologist said ahead of time. Screening is based on the standards that are set by the Department of Education and the Department of Health. Really led by the Department of Health for what we will do in early childhood screening. And as the physician mentioned, there are a lot of organizations that come together to look at what those recommendations are. And by changing what early childhood screening law asks us to do in schools, we're going to be kind of caught in a hard spot between the law and what the best practice standards are. So I'd ask you to think about that. The other thing is early childhood screening is just that. We're asked to see children at younger and younger ages, between the ages of 3 and 5, but the emphasis is now on 3-year-olds. And reading's just not a part of what 3-year-olds do. So I'm not sure that we would discover anything that would answer some of the very heartbreaking stories we just heard that happen as a child gets into the more academic time of life. So I would just like to ask you to consider that not putting our early childhood screening program in a difficult position against the standards that are set. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
If I might interrupt, perhaps next Tuesday we could hear from others who have concerns. I think the School Boards Association and some others might want to speak. And then we could answer a few questions if...
That's fine. We have time for that next Tuesday.
Let our committee administrator determine.
Unless others on the committee have any opposition.
I think members would like to ask some questions. And,
yes.
And I'm glad we've had these folks here.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Erickson, and appreciate all the testifiers and so forth. The committee is adjourned.
Thank you.